Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So it's my great pleasure to be here today with Anna Middleton, who is a world expert on these topics around genomics and ethics and trust. Anna, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, it's lovely to be here.
Well, thanks for spending time with us. You are a social scientist and a practicing genetic counsellor. You founded and head up the Society and Ethics Research Group at the Wellcome Genome Campus in the UK. I would say that you're probably one of the most important people in the UK for us to talk to when it comes to helping us to understand and hopefully embrace genomic technology as a society. Tell us a bit about how does one become an expert in the ethics of genetics and genetic counselling and so on. It's probably not the kind of thing that your school careers advisor says, you know what, Anna, what you should do. How did it come about?
Oh, that's a lovely introduction. Well, I've always been fascinated by both people and families. I think we all have very interesting families when we start to sort of delve into them. And I was also very interested in psychology. So I did genetics as my first degree. I knew very early on I didn't want to work in a laboratory, but I wanted to work with people. And so I then trained as a genetic counsellor. And what always fascinated me about working in the NHS with families was that the experience that they have with engaging with genetics is just unique to them. So every consultation would be different. There'd be something wonderfully magical about the engagement process, what made sense for people, what made meaning for them. And I was really a conduit to helping them access the technology and the screening services and to help hold them in a moment while they're grappling with often quite extreme emotions, guilt, blame, stigma, grief. And that was a real privilege. And I felt that I wanted to research that in more depth and so then became a full-time genetic counselling academic. And that's when I moved more into ethics. So genetics and ethics go hand in hand. They always have. I mean, the two are intertwined. And that's largely because genetic information not only belongs to an individual, but also belongs to a family, belongs to a community, belongs to a society. So there's lots of tension there between the movement of information, the ownership of information, and what it means to individuals in that kind of journey. So that's always just been so fascinating to me. And so after doing my PhD in psychology, I then, you know, really wanted to focus as an academic in that space. And very fortunate that Wellcome has fully funded my group and me to do work on that.
Fantastic. And as you say, these moments in people's lives can be so profound and the emotions can be so strong. As reflecting on one of our participants in the 100,000 Genomes Project at Genomics England was a little boy called Owen, who had a developmental disorder and took part in the program and got a diagnosis as part of that. And the thing that really struck me from talking to the family was his mother's reaction. And she said, I was so relieved when we got the diagnosis, because deep down I'd always thought, what had I done wrong that this had happened to Owen, to our boy? And it seems almost, to an outsider, it seems almost crazy. Of course, you know, how could you feel guilty about that? It's just a genetic thing, right? But we tend to have such intense human emotions. It's part of being human, I guess, right? And help us maybe understand that. Like, what kind of emotions do you come across, or what kind of stories do you come across in a way in which you can share?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there in terms of what we feel is often different from what we know. So we can know logically that it isn't our fault, and a genetic counsellor or geneticist can tell you it's not your fault. You know, there's a genetic cause to this. But what you feel based on your own life experience can be so powerful, it can overrule all of that. So people actually may not believe know, what the science is saying. And so there's this kind of need to have that integration of both perspectives and a space to explore the meaning of it. I actually myself have a family history of Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And so I grew up with a sort of disease in the family, knowing it existed, knowing it was very, very painful for the family to talk about, but also because it was so painful, not knowing quite how to ask about it, because, you know, you didn't want to sort of start conversations that were difficult for people. And also at the same time, my cousin had Duchenne muscular dystrophy and was dying from it. So there was all that kind of containment of emotion and confusion and fear and, you know, seeking and searching for information, but at the same time wanting to do that without worrying anybody. And it's just so fraught with all sorts of complex thoughts. So yeah, so growing up with that personal experience is very meaningful for me in helping me think about how it is for other people, how it might be for other people. But also I'm a parent of a child with autism as well, so a separate, completely separate and independent condition. And I'm one of the participants in the 100,000 Genomes Project as well. So my husband and myself and my son are participants. And that experience was really fascinating as a genetic counsellor, going through the consent process and the testing process and have the geneticist explain to me what genes were and assuming that I...
Did you have a quiet word and say, I do actually have a PhD in this?
Well, no, she knew, but it was because I was involved right at the beginning at helping the conversations about the consent material. So it was quite interesting to suddenly then be on the receipt of the consent material. And I remember when we had our consultation, you know, I was fine. I knew what was going on. But after we left, my husband said, I have no idea what any of that was about. Just want the test. You know, I don't really care what sequencing is or, you know, how they do it or any of those things. I just want to know what might they be able to say or not. So, you know, really interesting from both perspectives, I think there. But yeah, I mean, I've throughout my career, I've met a lot of people who are patients at the moment, or historical patients, or they're patients in waiting. They don't yet know that they will become patients, and, you know, public audiences who haven't yet had any kind of social interaction with genomics, and all they have to go on is popular culture media, things that they're fed.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right? And I mean, one of the things that has really struck me, which is a sort of completely banal and obvious observation, but I think is relevant in this context, is how differently sick people and well people think about these topics. And sick people tend to, by far from being ignorant at all, have often become world experts in their condition or their child's condition, and really become extremely engaged on these topics. And well people, as you say, can sometimes either feel that this is something for someone else or just have very high level and maybe incorrect or kind of fictional understanding of these topics. How can we have a conversation as a society when not just this distinction between sick and well people, but there's so many different views? How can we even have that conversation?
Well, it's really very tricky, and the conversation needs to be tailor-made to the audience. I think that idea of well people is also very interesting within the context of genetics, because often what we're doing is trying to predict disease in the future at a time point where the person is currently well and they don't yet have disease. So it's taking them from not feeling like they're a patient. So they might be a relative or related to somebody who is ill, but then they have a prediction that tells them they may get ill at some point in the future. So it's very hard to suddenly incorporate a new way of thinking about yourself. But I mean, from what I've learned empirically over the years around engaging is, yes, once people know why they need to have bought into the sort of conversation, because they're a patient or because it's relevant to their family or because they've had a whole series of, you know, deaths in the family or miscarriages or disease or whatever, that they're ready and they're listening and they're wanting to engage. Whereas those people who haven't yet had that experience, why would they care? Why would they need to know about any of this? And the reason that they would need to know about any of this is because even if they've never had any level of testing themselves and have no thoughts about any testing, even if they've never done an ancestry.com test or a 23andMe test, or they've never had any health testing, or they've never taken part in biobank research, they may think, well, this isn't relevant to me. But actually, they will be related to somebody who has, even very distantly, amongst relatives they don't even know. And so the issues, the ethical issues raised by genomics and data storage and privacy and concerns and discrimination are really relevant to all of us now. So it feels as if it's time to kind of bring those wider public audiences up gently, up to speed with some of these issues. In the same way that now most of us have heard of climate change, even if we don't know any of the details really in the science, we need to do the same for genomics. Because certainly we know empirically, when you say the word genomics or genome, the vast majority, 85% in the UK, have never heard of this. You know, they really have no idea what it is. And they will break down the word phonetically because it's completely alien. Is it to do with gnomes and economics? Was one thing that came out from participants in our research. So the word itself has the potential to alienate and disorientate and also create a hierarchical kind of expert, you know, elite kind of thing. And that's what we want to be getting away from. We want to be leveling this so that we can engage and for people to feel that this is relevant to them. It's not just for the experts.
Yeah, so it's difficult, right? Because we've mentioned a few things so far. One is the range of emotions that people can feel when they do have to get their heads around these topics, right? Which often may come in an unexpected way. Another is that often when we use words like genomics, they don't necessarily clarify, they may just confuse. Or even when we try and unpick that, you mentioned your husband's response to those conversations, you know, I don't care about all that stuff. I just want to get the test. I just want to get an answer. From all of your work, I guess, both in psychology and your academic research, but also your involvement in programs like the Topple Review and our own kind of public dialogue on genomic medicine, what is it about a person's genetic information that makes them think about it in that more emotional way, and how can we engage in a way that's productive in that context?
Well, the honest answer to that question is we actually don't know, because empirically we've not done social sciences research on that, or there's not a large body of research on that. We actually don't know something very, very basic, which is how do we help people to connect to this? What are the trigger words and concepts and constructs that perk them up and go, oh yes, this is for me? Is it to do with inheritance and family and connections in the family? My hunch is it's probably that. Is it to do with pop culture and, you know, X-Men and, you know, mutations and doing something different to us? Is it to do with police and crime? I mean, that might be the only way that people have actually heard about any of this, is to do with DNA databases and identifying bodies. You know, that might be the way in. We actually don't know what it is that connects people that you can then build on, you know, to actually have a conversation. So I think figuring that out, you know, as the first piece of empirical research would be very, very helpful. And then once we understand that, you can then start to springboard a conversation. And this is really where we're talking about proper, decent dialogue. So this isn't about expert telling non-expert stuff about genetics, you know, explaining what sequencing is or what a gene is or protein coding genomes or genome sequencing or any of that. It's just meaningless, really, without the context of why should I even care and why is this relevant to me? And if the in to the conversation is X-Men and mutations, then let's go with that. Let's build on that. Difference, you know, yeah. Maybe it's to do with difference and special powers and something in the DNA that makes you do something slightly different. You know, maybe that's the way in. And that involves a dialogue. So it has to be this kind of shared space where the expert and the non-expert, and I hate those kind of terms because we're all experts in our own lives, come together to create a shared, we call it a hybrid space, a new space together where we both learn from each other about, you know, what we feel about this, what we know about this, what we want from this.
Yeah. And in that hybrid space, there's so much going on. And as you say, everyone is expert in different elements of this, right? And everyone, I say everyone, almost most people today are making trade-offs about data, either implicitly or explicitly, all the time, around social media, around their location, around their shopping habits, and so on. What is it in this context that makes genomic data different from those other data conversations that, or data trade-offs that lots and lots of people are making all day, every day?
So we've actually asked that empirically in our research. So we did this study called, and in fact, it's still going at the moment, called Your DNA, Your Say, and it's a global public attitude study. So we've gathered the views from 37,000 people in 22 countries, and we translated this into 15 languages. So it's just been fascinating to see genomic data sharing in Urdu and Japanese and Mandarin and Russian and all these different languages. And so, you know, from that, we've explored, you know, and explained, because that's the first thing, is we know that broad public audiences are not very familiar with any of this. So we've tried to explain in a very neutral and biased way some of the background and the metaphors around this. But we asked people, you know, have you heard of any of this? And, you know, most people across the different countries outside of the USA and Italy, interestingly, most people haven't heard of genomic research or data sharing. We've also explained, you know, that genomic data can offer information about family and inheritance and things. And then we've explained how it might be different from other health data, like a cholesterol reading or an X-ray, that's exploring one specific kind of clinical situation. And we asked people to explore whether they felt that genomic data should be handled differently to health information. And they were saying things like, well, no, not really. They should equally be protected. But they were saying genomic data is special in some way because it has all these extra characteristics. It's passed through a family. It's shared with relatives. It can tell me about my past, present and future health. It can tell me about my children. It can tell me about my ancestors. And so there were these exceptionist views about genomic data as being something a little bit different. And so, again, that might be a way in to sort of bring in the sort of specialness of it and the kind of how it's different to other sorts of health data. That might be the way to start a conversation. But what I found fascinating from that data was that people weren't saying, no, it has to have exceptional management. They weren't saying it's so special that we have to do something different with it in terms of security or management or sharing. They're just saying, no, everything, health data, banking data, online photographs, Facebook data, it should all be equally protected.
And so as we try and move forward with that dialogue, I guess there's a set of skills out there in places like advertising agencies and other areas around storytelling, actively engaging with people. How do you think we can bring some of those skills to bear in genomics in the way that we have, for example, in areas like climate change, or, you know, leading these kind of big conversations?
Yeah, so I think as a genomics industry, we have to accept that our expertise has limits and that we need to bring in the expertise of others who are very familiar and skilled in not just passive engagement, but active engagement. So a lot of what we do at the moment in the genomics industry is public engagement, which relies on public voting with their feet to come to an event or to read a piece of written material or to respond to an invitation to something. So basically, they, at that point, they can decide, well, this isn't for me, I'm not going to engage. Or the other thing that we do within the genomics industry is media. So media and comms, so putting out a press release about a story or a latest scientific finding. And again, for the public audience, you have to vote with your feet to actually engage with it. Now, I'm particularly interested in how you avoid that passive stuff, which is great, and that should all continue, but you do something a bit more active and a bit more subliminal. So what are the techniques that the advertisers use to basically sell us a washing machine? You know, what's the really clever kind of framings for this that can help take us, not necessarily, you know, this is not about recruiting people or shifting people to be really positive about this, but taking people from currently very disengaged to engaged, or antisocial to social, or unfamiliar to familiar. How do you make that shift? And that's where we need the expertise of those really creatives, you know, storytellers and advertisers, marketers, PR people.
It's a great point. And as we think about that, that feels like a journey of engagement, right? We talk about there's a paying attention or turning up stage. There's a engaging and thinking about it stage. There's a informed opinions on some of these topics. I don't know if there is an endpoint to this journey, but what are some outcomes that would tell us that journey is going well? I'm thinking of things like the Warnock review in the 1980s around human embryology and fertility. You know, do we need a kind of Warnock review of genomics that then results in specific outcomes that people, researchers can pin on their wall? Or what tells us that this is going well?
So we need to be much better at measuring shifts in things, and we're not doing that at the moment. So what outcomes do we actually want to see? Well, we want to see a more engaged public. We want to also see an engaged public that's able to make choices about what trust looks to them. And it's not just about public being more trusting, because that puts the onus on them. It's about the genomics industry being able to authentically communicate trust, and to do that really, really well.
And trust is one of those big words, right? Like, and how do we break that down into, you know, what does trustworthiness actually mean? How can we as an industry earn that trust?
So what we need to do, and this is what we've been doing again empirically in our research, is actually asking people, what does trustworthiness look like to you? What is a trusting service for you? And it's been fascinating. In our Your DNA, Your Say study, we've asked that question, and people have said things like, well, it's not a fancy website with all the names and photographs of the researchers. That doesn't matter to me. But I do want to know.
And you can hear the sound of researchers around the world fainting. Yeah, but that was such a great portrait photo.
We demonstrate integrity. You know, we look very, very serious and very experts. You know, again,
I have a stethoscope slung around my neck. What more do you want?
Yeah, exactly. That's enough. No, they're not interested in that. So they want to know, how will you personally benefit from my data and my participation? And please don't say it's things like, oh, we're going to cure cancer together and we're going to, you know, sort out rare disease. It's not interested in that. They want to know how you specifically will benefit. Is that through advances in your career? Is that through access to more funding? Is that through being able to get a better diagnosis quicker for your patients? How will you actually benefit? And I've not actually seen any, we're just starting to publish this research, but I've not seen any companies or researchers actually putting on their website personal benefit.
It's a very savvy question, right? That is a very sharp question, and it's a great point that you can't answer that question with kind of jargon and buzzwords, right? That's a great question. How else does it translate?
People aren't stupid, are they? They know that there is an exchange going on, and particularly for patients when they're feeling vulnerable and, you know, fully behind the clinical team around them. Of course, they're going to give their data. Of course, they're going to do absolutely everything they can to help others. Of course, they're wanting to sort of shift forward medicine. But if we sort of take a step back from that when they're not in that really vulnerable state, you know, what does reciprocity really look like? What is a good deal for both sides? And this isn't just about science taking from people. This is about science genuinely offering a partnership. And this is again about rebalancing that kind of equality thing where we are genuine partners. And that really is quite new. I mean, when I joined Sanger, which was 10 years ago, the thought that researchers might give back data to research participants or even take note of what research participants wanted was quite alien then. And Now it's just common parlance, isn't it? Of course, people have access to data and they want to be part of the journey and all of that. So yeah, it's quite a different culture, isn't it? But that's definitely the track that we want to be going on, is seeing, again, rebalancing the expert, non-expert, where we're just in partnership together. It's a shared experience.
It's a great point. And I think it is inspiring and encouraging in many ways how much that conversation has moved forward. So we're saying there's something about, you know, don't try and pull the wool over our eyes. Be clear about what you get out of this and what I get out of this. You know, what's the value exchange? And I don't think that needs to be transactional. It can just be realistic and non-paternalistic, right? Are there other elements of this that you think are really important practically for organizations like Genomics England, like the Sanger Institute and others, to take away from this?
Yeah, a tone of humility. And that's often not a word that you associate with the genomics industry, is humility. But I think that's really what people are after, is transparency, humility, and an open mind. So I don't think people are expecting, you know, us all to have all the answers. I think it's okay to be uncertain, but what we want to be saying is that come on this journey with us and we will do our best for you. So these are the themes that came out of the Ipsos Mori work on the social contract, So that was the piece of focus group and interview work that was exploring public attitudes to this. What do they want from genomic medicine? And there were three key themes. It was solidarity, that we're together in this. Reciprocity, what's the exchange? You know, what do I get back? What do you get from me? And are both sides happy with this? Is it a win-win for both sides? And then altruism. It's not enough to expect people to be altruistic, but they are willing to be altruistic if the other things are in place and there's a real humility around the whole kind of process.
Got it. So to some extent, we have to earn that altruism, right? The altruism is available, but we just can't take it for granted.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love the focus on humility as well. There's a concept that I love from the world of kind of leadership, around servant leadership, that actually as leaders we exist in order to serve the people who we're leading. And I've had some colleagues previously say to me, well, that's all very well, but it sounds a bit fluffy and kind of whatever. I was like, well, actually the leading textbook on this is called Serve to Lead, which is the textbook that people get at Sandhurst when they're doing officer training for the military. So, you know, it's not something that's completely fluffy, but I love the concept of bringing that mindset to trying to lead a conversation. How do you lead a conversation? You don't lead a conversation well by shouting louder and kind of telling people things. You lead a conversation well with humility. I think that's really powerful.
And by listening. So it's actually two-way dialogue, yeah.
And I think altruism is a hugely inspiring concept. And again, maybe let's try and bring that to life a little bit. You must have been involved in lots of conversations that are challenging, but also lots of conversations that are inspiring. What should we take away around altruism to, I guess, both inspire ourselves, but also to try and encourage more of it?
In a way, the genome is the metaphor for that altruism, because what it is a connection to our past and our present and our future, but it's also a connection between people. It's also a connection, even though it's a biological connection, it's also a cultural connection. It's also a device for cutting through difference, because really we're not that different from each other. So when we're talking about altruism, I think, you know, you can even use the sort of concepts of genomics as the way to talk about this, because you can't interpret what one variant means in one person without having access to thousands, hundreds of thousands of variants from other people who very, very kindly at some point in their journey donated that data. So they've been willing to share their data so that this person can get their variant interpreted. It's about connection. The way you know, what happens to the data will inform and influence future treatments and, you know, personalized care that will benefit somebody else. This is all about connection. So, you know, once you sort of start to think of it in that way, you build a very human story that you can then have a conversation around. So again, going back to the beginning, which is how do you start these conversations? These are some of the themes that would be great to really pull out in personal stories to then engage with public audiences who don't yet know anything about this. Because everyone can appreciate that connection idea, can't they?
And in fact, I was just about to say the same thing. We're kind of coming back to where we started, which is great, which is this concept of family as well, and the interconnectedness of, to some extent, an immediate, quote-unquote, nuclear family, if such a thing still exists. But then also the family of a community, whether that's a research community that has jointly donated their data to help others with the same condition. Or, as you put it, there's actually a human family point here as well, around actually we're more united than we are divided by what we find in the genome. And irrespective of some of the superficial characteristics like skin color or eye color or, you know, the shape of our ears or noses or whatever, that's hugely inspiring. And as you reflect on the conversations that you've had with families in that narrower sense over your career, are there any stories you can tell or situations you can bring to life where you've really seen all of these elements come together around trust, around engagement, around powerful conversations? What does that look like when we get it right?
Well, goodness, as a genetic counsellor, I can think of loads of powerful stories where the power came from the family as opposed to the genetic testing or the genetics information that we were giving them. And so, oh gosh, some examples. Okay, so I remember seeing a man who had recently discovered that his sister had a BRCA1 variant, and it was discovered because she had terminal ovarian cancer that was picked up too late, basically, so she was dying. This man came very urgently for BRCA predictive testing because he had two daughters that were about to get married, and he wanted to pass on this information to them. And he wanted to have testing without telling his daughters because he wanted to know the results before really finding out whether they would want to know themselves. And so the counselling session was very much focused on, you know, there's no problem, you can have a test, but let's, you know, indulge me, let's have 30 minutes just talking through the timing of this and whether this feels right for you and what you want to do with the information. And when we started the conversation, he just cried. He cried and cried. And he talked about his two girls and how he didn't actually know that they would really want to know this information, and he didn't want to be the bearer of bad news. He was basically having a test because he wanted it to be negative so that he could give them good news. But if it was not good news, then we had to think through what he was going to do next. And I was sort of telling him, well, you know, they wouldn't be able to start screening until they're a bit older anyway, even if they were found to have the same mutation. So why don't we think about putting it off a little bit? Or, you know, let's think about that. Anyway, so we had a sort of good hour together. And at the end of it, he said, I want to go away and talk about this to my girls before I do anything else. And that's what he did. And then he came back a year later and he said, we're not ready to know. So that felt the right thing for him. It was his decision. It was a family decision, actually, because he'd brought his girls in. But it was so touching and so moving. And, you know, there's all these kind of oscillating themes about altruism, you know, he wanting to do something for his children, doing good by them, you know, balancing doing good versus doing harm, all these ethical principles, timing, fear, and also dealing with his sister who is dying. So very, very powerful, and a real kind of demonstration to me that, you know, the testing is so much more than the actual test and the technology. It's the impact of this, and having space to have conversations about it is so important.
Well, I was going to say, it's creating that space, isn't it? And then almost irrespective of what the decision is in the end, having created that conversation, I guess, between you and him, but also between him and his daughters, that's where the magic happens, right? Is where we create those spaces. I think you mentioned hybrid spaces earlier, where we can meet as human beings, not as a doctor and a patient or as an expert and someone who's learning, but as 2, 3, 4 human beings in a situation.
And if there's any messaging that Genomics England could do, it would be so helpful to hear that other side of the testing journey and process, because there's so much focus on how shiny the technology is and how incredible, you know, the number of panels there are and the pipelines and, you know, the industry and how much money this is going to create for the UK industry, and this is all so exciting and big, and but yet there are really heartfelt human stories, you know, individual stories that go with every single test, and that takes time to unpick. And there's only 300 genetic counselors in the UK. There's not nearly enough to pick up the pieces, and this is going mainstream. So, you know, nurses, other health professionals are going to be having these conversations. And there needs to be time put aside to them. You know, 10 minutes isn't enough. It really isn't.
It's, well, with the jobs and the investment and bioinformatics and machine learning, it feels like you've been sitting in on my conversations around the spending review, but the good thing is that with the human side and how we have these conversations better, it also feels like you're sitting in a lot of the conversations that we're having around how we as Genomics England can better engage with patients, with participants, but also with the general public who are not at that point in the journey, as you said. So it feels like this is simultaneously the end of a brief conversation that we've had today, but also hopefully the beginning of a longer conversation that we have both with you and your team and with the wider public. But huge, huge thanks for sharing your story and some of your insights with us today.
Oh, you're so welcome. Let's chat again another day.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.